Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Thousands are left homeless by the recent storm that ravaged North Florida.
He had told the sheriff not to move anybody out of their apartments. There's a crisis over there. The whole city is, there's 10,000 people without a place to live.
Also this week, Hurricane Michael destroyed lives, homes, businesses, and almost brought the region's entire financial services network to its knees.
We were trying just to get cash in the hands of our members so that they could get the things they needed, just fuel and food, and start to rebuild their lives.
We'll also get the latest on allegations the Democratic candidate for Florida governor accepted improper gifts from an undercover FBI agent investigating corruption in Tallahassee, although we'll also learn that and other political conflicts may not be the most important things in the minds of many Floridians. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. In storm-ravaged Panama City, a new crisis is emerging: housing. Across the city, evictions are taking place as apartment complexes and rental units are being condemned. Many of these are rent-controlled and income-based. Lynn Hatter reports that's leaving hundreds of people scrambling for places to go. For some, there's nowhere to go.
The Panama City Housing Authority's website has a sign up on its homepage.
If you live at Masolina or Fletcher Black, all residents have been requested to relocate. If you live at any of our other communities and your apartment has been heavily damaged, unfortunately, you will be required to relocate as well.
The Housing Authority says half of its 600 units have been damaged by the storm. Its phones are down, and it's directing residents to reach out to FEMA. It's also told people they have only days to vacate the premises. The Housing Authority serves poor residents, many of whom cannot afford to just pack up and go. Tanja Graham is one of them.
We live in low housing because I don't have the money right now to afford a regular house. Like, so that was a home that I built for my children, which was taken away in a disaster. And then to have to leave unwillingly and, like, forcefully without anywhere to go, without any money, without any resources on anything, is messed up. Like, I have nowhere to go.
Hurricane Michael destroyed the Macedonia Gardens apartment that she, her two young children, and elderly parents lived in. While Macedonia Gardens is not under the oversight of the Panama City Housing Authority, it is considered affordable housing, and it's subsidized by the federal government. Graham got a letter telling her she had 72 hours to leave. It was taped to the doors in the middle of the night shortly after the storm.
There still has not been any information given, even though they gave us this notice to 72 hours to evacuate. There was not any legal document stating that we had to leave. There was no legal anything, just a piece of paper stating that we had 72 hours to go. I don't have anywhere to go with my kids.
Graham is presently living in her father's truck with her two young children and her parents. She can't get to a shelter because her checking account is overdrawn, there's no money for gas, and the truck has a broken axle.
You're aware of what's going on with the evictions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've already been over to several of the complexes. Yeah. Personally, we've had people going over there. And we just heard from the mayor today of Panama City.
Legal Services of North Florida's litigation director, Scott Mannion.
Basically, he said that he had told the sheriff not to move anybody out of their apartments. Mm. There's a crisis over there. The whole city is, there's 10,000 people without a place to live. All the daycare centers are destroyed. All the nursing homes are destroyed. They can't find any of the teachers. They can't get the schools open. It's a crisis.
The lack of housing only adds to that crisis. Damage to several low-income housing complexes means some are in the process of being condemned. But Mannion says even under that circumstance, tenants still have rights.
There's no three-day notice. Only the tenant has the power to terminate the lease and get their security deposit back when there's a disaster. Unless there's something else, if their lease was over with, which I doubt it'd be over with in the middle of the month or the end of the month.
Tanja Graham's apartment complex referred her to one in New Orleans as a possible housing option. But when she called, she says the manager had no idea what she was talking about. And that raises another issue. When government-subsidized housing becomes unlivable, owners and landlords are obligated to help their tenants relocate.
And there are processes in place that streamline the ability for owners to place their tenants in other similar available units throughout the communities.
Barbara Ezell is head of the property section of the Florida Bar. Federal law makes provisions on what to do when properties have been condemned, which is happening now in Panama City. But Ezell says those three-day notices telling people to leave, those are likely illegal. And even if a property has been condemned, a formal eviction notice still has to be issued.
They have to go through the Florida eviction process. They can't just tell you to go. If you go voluntarily, that's one thing, but they can't. They would have to go through the legal process for eviction.
Both legal services of North Florida's Mannion and Ezell say the best thing for these residents is to stay put and contact FEMA. The federal agency provides temporary housing for hotels and longer-term rental assistance. But it's one or the other, not both, says FEMA spokeswoman Nikki Gaskins.
Exactly. But if you get rental assistance, understand that when that grant money is provided to you, you could use that money for an hotel. So basically, for rental assistance, if you get rental assistance, you can use the money for a hotel, you can use the money for an apartment, obviously, a home, even an RV, anywhere where you can live.
The temporary shelter assistance, called TSA, is good for up to 14 days. Yet the list of participating hotels on FEMA's website does not show any in the immediate Panama City area. And there are only about 20 in the entire panhandle. Hotel participation in the program is voluntary. And Gaskins says people may have to travel far to find a place. The same is true for those who get the longer-term rental assistance.
We want to encourage people, like, if they need a place to stay, you do have options. They may not be ideal option, but there are options out there. The first is to apply with FEMA if you think you need to. And then that's going to get the ball rolling, and it's going to help determine whether you qualify for maybe the TSA program or potentially rental assistance.
That rental assistance is what Tanja Graham is waiting for. She says she was told her check was mailed October 23rd, and she's hoping it comes soon.
Yes, ma'am, hopefully. That's hopefully, because I called several times and they've given me several different answers.
The Panama City Housing Authority says half of its 450 apartments will likely be condemned. The letter Tanja Graham received from her landlord says of the 600 properties the company owns in the area, almost all on the city side will also have to be condemned. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Remember the old saying that you never miss the water till the well runs dry? Well, disasters like Hurricane Michael a few weeks back often serve to remind people just how dependent they become on systems that are barely given a second thought in normal times. Take the financial services industry, for example. It's brought us credit and debit cards and phone apps so we can conveniently buy whatever we desire. And when we need a few dollars of old-fashioned cash, we just go to the nearest ATM and make a quick withdrawal. But what do you do when the ATM, and maybe even the bank it's connected to, have literally blown away?
One of our branches was hit so hard that we've had to move portable branches in to service our customers because the building as it stands right now is not capable of being used.
That's Emery Mayfield, the Tallahassee market president for Hancock Whitney, which has banks all across the Gulf Coast. But he also says his bank and others in the region weren't totally unprepared.
Our company, Hancock Whitney, learned a lot from Hurricane Katrina back in 2005 when 90% of our branches were destroyed. And so we employed a lot of those lessons into helping us recover as quickly as possible from Hurricane Michael.
Commercial banks like Mayfield's weren't the only financial institutions impacted by the storm. Scott Gladden is Senior Vice President of Innovations Federal Credit Union that operates exclusively in storm-tossed Bay County.
Our first few days, we were trying just to get cash in the hands of our members
so that they could get the things they needed, just fuel and food, and start to rebuild their lives.
Gladden says severe damage to the area's digital infrastructure meant many of the businesses that were open were in cash-only mode because they had no way to process credit or debit card purchases. Things are a bit better now, but Gladden says untold numbers of people are falling behind in their loan payments.
We're letting them skip payments for up to 90 days until they get their lives back together.
He says his credit union and most other financial institutions are cutting their storm-hammered customers slack in other ways.
We've stopped charging late fees on those loans. We've suspended that. We've suspended credit bureau reporting for a period of time. For those members who have mailed their checks in, but the Postal Service can't get the check to us, we're not going to affect their credit report negatively.
Gladden says even for those whose damaged property was covered by windstorm insurance, there are hefty deductibles.
We've offered a hurricane assistance loan for people to pay the deductible on their insurance or to start to rebuild their lives.
But it's not only homeowners who need help with recovery. Gladden says his credit union is unique in that it now has the capability to help area businesses get back on their feet.
Our credit union actually received a grant this past year through the U.S. Treasury for small business growth. We believe if we can help small businesses, I mean really small businesses, then we can help create jobs, put money back into our economy. And we're looking to try to expand some of that to help local small business owners who are members of the credit union help rebuild their companies.
For the area's commercial banks, Hancock Whitney's Emery Mayfield says assisting that commercial rebound is also a top priority.
You know, our company, Hancock Whitney, has donated $200,000 to set up relief accounts throughout Northwest Florida. Other banks such as Wells Fargo, SunTrust, Regions, and J.P. Morgan, and Bank of America have all written large checks to help in the relief effort. So that's one form of capital that our industry is providing.
At the same time, he says there's assistance at the federal and state levels that his industry can help facilitate.
We are also encouraging businesses to go to the state of Florida and the Department of Economic Opportunity because they have special loans that can assist impacted businesses.
Still, both Mayfield and Gladden say the areas and the people most severely impacted by Hurricane Michael will have a long, painful path back to any semblance of full recovery. More than 2 million voters have already cast ballots in the battleground state of Florida, and so far Republicans seem to have the edge. New statistics released today by the State Division of Elections show that nearly 560,000 people have voted early this week. In addition to that, nearly 1.5 million people have voted by mail. Nearly 870,000 GOP voters have cast ballots compared to slightly more than 808,000 for Democrats. There are more than 13 million registered voters in the state. Florida voters are choosing whether their new governor should be Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum or former U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis. Outgoing Governor Rick Scott also is challenging U.S. Senator Bill Nelson in a race that could determine control of the U.S. Senate. And speaking of Governor Scott, he's getting back on the campaign trail after spending more than 2 weeks dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Michael. Despite being embroiled in that tight race with U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, Scott has spent most of his time in the Florida Panhandle counties damaged by the storm. The Republican governor contends his decision to focus on storm recovery efforts was not political and was just part of the job. Still to come on Capitol Report, will a flap over who paid for a Broadway show ticket torpedo the gubernatorial hopes of Andrew Gillum? The candidate insists there's no problem.
I arrived at the theater and received my ticket from my brother.
While early voting is underway, elections officials say some people just aren't thinking about heading to the polls.
Food, shelter, that's going to come first, of course. And then voting is kind of down the line.
And we'll explore why it costs so doggone much to get your car fixed nowadays.
Get educated on them. They will help you be safer, but you got to know what their limitations are.
A Tampa Bay Times report this week showed Democratic gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum accepted a ticket to the Broadway musical Hamilton from an undercover FBI agent in 2016. Ryan Daly reports Gillum and his lawyer have both maintained the candidate received the ticket from his brother.
The revelation has been called an October surprise by some and dismissed by others. The Hamilton ticket is one key piece of a state ethics board investigation that has Gillum at its center. Also ongoing is an FBI investigation involving lobbyist Adam Corey, who along with Gillum and undercover FBI agents also attended the play in New York City. In a September interview, Gillum's lawyer Barry Richard vehemently defended the candidate's story that Gillum's brother, Marcus Gillum, provided the Hamilton ticket.
He met his brother in New York to go see Hamilton, and his brother gave him a ticket to Hamilton. So there's a big uproar over where did the ticket come from? Did it come from Adam Corey? Because Corey went as well. Adam Corey and Andrew and his brother have been friends since college.
In text messages published in the Times report, Corey tells Gillum the undercover agent, going by the name Mike Miller, and his friends, quote, have tickets for us. Richard, in the September interview, said Corey was not the one who procured the ticket.
Nobody, including Corey, has said that Corey gave them the ticket. And nobody has said that.
Responding to the Times story, Gillum maintains he got the ticket from his brother. During the most recent gubernatorial debate, Republican candidate Ron DeSantis pressed Gillum on findings from the Times report.
Now think about what he wants you to believe. He wants you to believe that he's not under investigation. Why would an undercover FBI agent posing as a contractor give him a $1,000 ticket to Hamilton? And so he was asked the question by me, did you pay for it? He was indignant. He says, I'm a grown man. I pay for my stuff. He lied the other day. The text messages show he knew it came from Mike Miller, who he didn't know was an undercover FBI agent at the time, but now we know that.
Gillum shot back with his explanation of the events 2 years ago.
I did go and see Hamilton. I was aware that Adam Corey and Mike Miller arranged so that we could go and see the show. I arrived at the theater and received my ticket from my brother.
Gillum went on to denounce the notion he would take gifts for political gain and fended off accusations he is the focus of a federal probe.
I am not the subject of an FBI investigation. Neither is my city. There is absolutely no proof to substantiate that. And my opponent is going out of his way to attempt to make that the case, but I have zero tolerance for corruption.
Barry Richard, Gillum's lawyer, said last month he does not expect the state ethics board investigation to conclude before the November election. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Florida's gubernatorial election is getting national attention, but in some parts of the Sunshine State, voting is the last thing on people's minds. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
It's just a nightmare out here. We're doing everything we can, helping everybody we can.
That's Jared Brand. He's sweeping up bits of debris littering the parking lot of a shopping center in Marianna. He says residents are doing their best to help one another return to normal after Hurricane Michael. But he says that recovery is a long way off.
That's really, it's the same everywhere from Panama City all the way to Midland City, Alabama. But it's bad. It's the worst I've ever seen.
I'm sure that the number one concern is their welfare, health, food, shelter. That's going to come first, of course. And then voting is kind of down the line.
Sylvia Stevens is the supervisor of elections in Jackson County. She says while some people have contacted her office, she imagines many haven't given voting much thought. And she says voters aren't the only ones struggling to recover from the storm. Many of the county's usual polling places are damaged or being used for rescue and cleanup efforts.
They're being used for emergency staging areas or distribution centers. And, of course, we're not going to run them out to have an election.
But Stevens says one thing that's helping is an executive order issued recently by Governor Rick Scott. It's made it easier for storm victims to use vote-by-mail ballots.
Some of them have been displaced to another state or city, because of the hurricane and staying with relatives. And so we were appreciative with Governor Scott to waive the law that it had their address, if it's not on file, must be in writing. And so they can just call us, give us the address where they need their ballot mailed to, and we'll mail it to them. And, of course, all vote-by-mail ballots must be back in our office by 7 p.m. Election Day, which is November the 6th.
And Franklin County Election Supervisor Heather Riley says she's seen more and more people take that option.
Since Michael, we've actually had a daily increase in our vote-by-mail requests.
Riley says in her neck of the woods, where recovery is further along but still an uphill battle, the storm may be giving voters even more reason to head to the polls.
Just because they're going to want to make sure that they're able to have people in place that are going to be able to continue, you know, with the help that's coming in and the help that they'll continue to need.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Meanwhile, Florida's U.S. senatorial race has some implications beyond the obvious. The Kennedy Space Center receives about $2.6 billion each year from Congress. Lawmakers like Senator Bill Nelson help steer policy and money to the state. Governor Rick Scott is challenging Nelson for his seat, and policy experts are worried that could put Florida's space dollars in jeopardy.
When the space shuttle Columbia launched from the Kennedy Space Center on January 12, 1986, the crew of seven included then-Congressman Bill Nelson.
Four, three, two, one. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Liftoff of Columbia on mission 61C, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
The NASA program that sent Nelson to space was a way for politicians to get a hands-on look at the work of the space agency. The Kennedy Space Center in Florida has launched every human U.S. space mission and dozens of robotic missions. University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett says Nelson has played a key role in shaping space policy.
Because the space program has been so important to Florida, and because the federal government has always had a big role in the space program, you know, he sought early on to get on to the Science and Technology Committee so he could have some say on that.
Nelson is now the ranking member of the Science, Commerce, and Transportation Committee, which steers legislation and funding for NASA, and that means funding for the Kennedy Space Center. But now the Democratic senator is in a tight race to hold on to his seat. His Republican challenger, Governor Rick Scott, has poured millions of dollars into the campaign. If he wins, he wouldn't automatically fill Nelson's seat on the committee. It would be up to GOP leadership to assign that role. Phil Larson is an assistant dean at the University of Colorado Boulder and former Obama White House advisor. He says that could open the door for senators from other states to take the spot.
So that's one of the key things you would lose, is kind of him positioned right now as the node for senatorial space issues.
WMFE reached out to the Scott campaign for its policy on space and have not heard back. But Scott is no stranger to the space industry. On his watch, private companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin have expanded their footprint since the end of the shuttle program in 2011. Here's Scott at a press conference in 2015.
But the most exciting thing about today is we're announcing that Blue Origin has picked the great state of Florida as their base of operation. They're going to invest over $200 million locally and add 330 jobs. So congratulations to everybody for making that happen.
Kennedy Space Center and the surrounding Cape Canaveral area have really rebounded since the 2011 low.
That's Laura Forsick, a space policy analyst and founder of Astrolytical.
And it's due in a large part because of state efforts through Space Florida and other organizations to really focus on boosting the economy and job creation.
Space Florida is the agency Scott oversees that courts aerospace business to the state. She says if Scott wins, it's in Florida's best interest if he asks for an assignment on the Senate subcommittee to steer federal dollars to the Space Coast.
I would think that he almost has to, because of the influence that Kennedy Space Center has in the nation's space industry and space activities. There should be a Florida senator within one of those committees.
On the campaign trail, Nelson and Scott have sparred over healthcare, disaster relief, and the environment, but not space policy. But the outcome of this race could have a big impact for Florida's Space Coast, says UCF's Aubrey Jewett.
If Senator Nelson loses office and then loses that seat on the committee, then NASA certainly would lose an ally and a friend here in Florida.
Recent polls have the candidates within single digits and no clear frontrunner. I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
There is a new connection between the state of Massachusetts and the state of Florida. Massachusetts House Speaker Robert DeLeo, Boston Police Commissioner William Gross, and Massachusetts Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters are among the public officials who plan to unveil a billboard next week in Boston. It will contrast Massachusetts gun laws with those in Florida. The billboard aims to compare the effective gun laws in Massachusetts with the lax, dangerous gun laws in Florida, particularly Florida's lack of criminal background checks, as well as unregulated and unrestricted access to assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. That, in the words of the Stop Handgun Violence Group. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, new technology is making cars safer, but reports from AAA indicate the technology is also raising repair bills and creating lazy drivers. Eleanor Clark has more.
The new reports are from AAA, which looks at advanced driver assistance systems. That's technology like automatic emergency braking, blind spot monitoring, and lane departure monitoring. The tech used to be an expensive upgrade, but now comes standard in many new vehicles. The reports show after collisions, cars with the advanced technology can cost 2 or 3 times as much to repair as cars without. And that isn't just for major accidents. Fender benders or even hitting a mailbox in cars with these systems could leave drivers with high repair bills. Matt Nasworthy is a spokesman for AAA.
And even like a minor collision, because a lot of this technology can be like in the front bumper and rear bumper, where normally, you know, it would have been less than $1,000, you could have double or triple that based on if you damaged a sensor or something of that nature.
The reports show advanced systems aren't just affecting wallets at the repair shop. They're also changing the way some people drive. Another study from AAA found Florida drivers with advanced systems don't know about the technology's limits. Researchers found 80% of drivers with blind spot monitoring thought the system could detect bikes, people, and cars passing at high speeds, but the systems aren't able to. In addition, the study found about 1/4 of drivers using blind spot monitoring felt comfortable relying on the technology alone, rather than looking for themselves. Nasworthy says drivers need to understand what the systems can and can't do.
Just be educated on what additional features are in the car that you haven't had before. If you don't have a comfortability with what those safety features are, get educated on them. They will help you be safer, but you got to know what their limitations are.
Nasworthy says the technology can make cars safer, but it should never be used as a replacement for safe driving habits. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Eleanor Clark.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Eleanor Clark and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.